You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. The city of Ashland established a sister city status more than 50 years ago with the city of Guanajuato, Mexico. And that cross-country relationship has flourished. A couple of years ago, however, the city of Ashland extended another hand of friendship to the city of Sviatohersk in Ukraine. And they accepted the opportunity. And that catalyzed the sister city relationship that continues through extraordinary circumstances of war in that country. Joining the exchange to help us learn more is Ben Stott. He's a founder of the Ashland Sviatohersk Aid Project, which petitioned the city of Ashland and precipitated the sister city relationship in 2023. Welcome to the exchange, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you recently returned from a trip to Ukraine, right?
That's true. I came back 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in what you actually learned while you were there. But before we get to that, help us understand how this sister city relationship first got started.
I've been going to Ukraine for the past, since the war started. I've had 4 trips there. I went because I felt a very strong desire to do something to help Ukraine. But I found as an individual, it was difficult because the needs of the country are so great and my capacity to make a difference was small. And so we came upon the idea of, rather than trying to help the whole country, to choose one small part, one city, and focus our attention there as a way to make a difference at a human scale. By helping people in one area, we felt we could actually make a significant difference and that it would be easier to explain what's going on and also to monitor the effects of our donations and our help if we could localize our efforts in one area.
And who all was involved?
We have a board. There's 6 of us that are working together to 2 things. One is to raise money to provide supplies, medical supplies, and infrastructure for the city, and also to catalyze interest in Ukraine in general, because, as you know, that the war will be won or lost dependent on the United States and Europe's continued attention. And so by creating a sister city project, we could leverage the bully pulpit of the city and the citizens of our town to create a more significant impact than I could do personally.
Okay, I want to talk about that sister city project and how it evolved. But tell me more about you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an acupuncturist. I haven't been socially a social activist. But when I heard the story of what was going on when Russia first invaded Ukraine, something touched me in a place that I can't explain, where I felt that I couldn't sit on the sidelines and watch because it seemed just a clear sense of moral outrage that Russia would be trying to impose its will on an independent country and deny them the right to choose their own future and their own form of government and their own opportunities, for example, to join the EU. Ukraine's a very, very different country than Russia. They have a democratic history at the time of the Cossacks. And the people there are independent. They're entrepreneurial. They want to have the freedom to choose their own way and have their own destiny. And so I wanted just to support that. And
I want to talk about the people and the history and how all of that came to be. But right now, I'm really interested in your interest and your focus.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up back east in Pennsylvania, and I moved to Ashland in 1989. I've traveled a lot in my life. I lived in India for many years, and So I don't know what more to say about myself.
You're somewhat of a global citizen. You have a global lens.
Yeah. So I didn't, it wasn't strange to me to feel engaged or interested in what's going on in Central Europe.
Okay. So what is the short-term and long-term vision for this sister city relationship that was established between Ashland and Svyatohirsk?
Mm-hmm. Well, because there's a war going on, it's a little different than Vanuatu in the sense that normally in a sister city project, it's a reciprocal relationship where, we provide things to the city and they also then reciprocally offer something back. Because of the war, it's a kind of we're taking care of them until they get their country back. And then we have every hope that there will be a long-term relationship, somewhat like Vanuatu, where we can have educational exchanges, cultural exchanges, potentially business opportunities. I might mention that when the war ends, Ukraine will be the most vibrant and exciting country in Europe in terms of economic development. So I think there, in the long term, there's a great future for a kind of interesting and rewarding relationship in terms of cultural exchanges. For example, as you might know, in December 14th, we're going to have a fundraiser where we'll have a lot of Ukrainian musicians and dancers showing off their cultural heritage. And I expect that to continue.
Okay. Yeah. My guest is Ben Stott. He's the founder of the Ashland Svyatohirsk Aid Project, which offers support for residents of Ashland's sister city in Ukraine. Now, Ben, you accompanied Ashland Mayor Tanya Graham on a trip to Ukraine.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, Tonya's been very supportive of our project from the beginning, but because she's very busy, she hasn't or hadn't had a chance to get personally involved. But in April, there was a conference for many cities and regional areas around the world to meet President Zelensky and network about how we could help Ukraine. So she and I went there to this conference. We heard President Zelensky talk. It was a chance to meet a lot of mayors and governors of even states came to Ukraine. And it was a time for Tonya to make a personal relationship with the mayor of Svyatohirsk, a man named Volodymyr Rybalkin, a very impressive man, who unfortunately lost his own son, who was driving a tank last spring. So he has personally suffered a lot, as has everyone in Ukraine. And so we had a lot of time. We toured around Kyiv. We went to Bucha, the famous place where there were so many Russian atrocities in the first year of the war. And it was a chance for them to make a personal relationship that I hope will last and will be kind of the centerpiece of a continuing relationship between the two towns.
Okay, so you traveled to Ukraine with Mayor Graham.
Yes.
The city council was involved in that?
The city council was very supportive. After we came back, we gave a talk and talked about our trip and Tonya showed some pictures of our visit. Last year, we made a movie about our town, Svyatohirsk, which we showed last year and which we will show again in our fundraiser on Sunday, December 14th, so people can have a chance to actually see the faces of the people who live there, meet the mayor, and get a personal feeling for what it's like to live in a land where every day you don't know whether you'll be alive the next day because of continual bombing. It's a very terrible situation which people in this country have. It's difficult for them to get their heads around the fact that life in a war zone is it's just a different world.
I cannot imagine. Now, I spent 12 years in the military, but fortunately, I was not. I didn't have to spend a lot of time in a war zone.
Yeah.
That being said, you flew into Sviatohersk. You flew into Ukraine with.
Yeah, we don't fly. There's a no fly zone, so it takes a long time to come by train from Poland.
So forgive me. So tell me about this trip. I mean, how do you get in and out of a war zone?
Well, normally you come to Kyiv or Lviv in the west, and then you either take a train or a bus to get where you're going. In order to get to Sviatohersk, this last trip, things have changed a lot since last year. And now, unfortunately, Sviatohersk is only 8 kilometers from the front lines, and there's daily bombardment. So to get in there was very difficult. We had to take just a two-hour window to go in and have to wear armor and helmets and stuff because there were so many drones. Most of the town has been evacuated. There are only about 100 citizens left in town.
In a population of what?
Originally, it was around 4,500 people.
Okay.
I might add that Sviatohersk is an extraordinarily beautiful town. It has a historic monastery there called a Lavra. It's been there since the 1200s, and it became a tourist mecca and a pilgrimage site. So the town was developed to provide for services for the people coming to visit this monastery. But unfortunately, when it was invaded and occupied by the Russians, 70% of the town was destroyed. And so at the time when I first went there 2 years ago, they had no electricity, no water, and all the services were provided by NGOs. Even to take a shower, they had to bring in water, and they had a communal place where people could go and wash, do their laundry. Food was provided by the NGO.
NGOs, non-governmental organizations.
Yeah. And the conditions were extremely difficult for people. Last year when we went there, and partially through our help, they had developed themselves so that they had electricity again, so which means heat, which is a big deal in the winter because it's very cold there.
And they're in the forested region?
Yeah, it's a forested region with a beautiful river running through the center of the town. And things were looking up last year. Unfortunately, this year the Russians have been pushing forward in the whole eastern area. It's called the Donetsk Oblast, which is like a state. And everyone's heard of Pokrovsk, which is not very far away to the south. And because of drone attacks, they started evacuating citizens. And now we're working Mero Balkan and with the help of our group and also a group that we're affiliated with called Ukraine Aid International. We're helping them. Now our focus is on helping provide services for the residents who've been forced to relocate, and we're trying to find a place where they can all go to one place so they can still keep a sense of community, even though they're displaced physically from their homes.
Now, you're talking about 4,000 people, and the town is now a
smattering. At the time, last year, there were about 1,200 people.
Okay.
And so now there's only about 100 people left, and those are people who don't have any relatives elsewhere in Ukraine or abroad to go and stay, and so they have nowhere to go. They're mostly elderly people, almost all elderly women. Most of the men are in the army, and the children have, been evacuated earlier to keep them safe. So we're in the process right now of trying to find a community where they can all stay together and maintain some sense of community, which is so important. And our focus on fundraising is now to provide vehicles that have enough armor that people can be evacuated safely and supplies can be brought into the town.
Okay, let's hold it right there. We need to take a short break. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Ben Stott. He's the founder of the Ashland Sviatohersk Aid Project. Before the break, we were talking about the residents here in Ashland who are pooling resources to provide aid to the residents of Sviatohersk. And Ben and Mayor Tanya Graham had traveled to Ukraine to see firsthand what was going on. Ben, what's been done so far?
Since we started, the first thing we needed to do was to help them to have water. And so in conjunction with the Ukraine Aid International, we provided them with a water filtration unit so that people could have access to clean drinking water. Secondly, we provided what's called a wood pellet machine, which makes fuel in the form of small pellets that could be used to heat municipal heating systems so that people whose houses had been destroyed, who were living in a communal center, would have could stay warm in the winter. After that, we bought them a large dump truck, which to enable them to get rid of their municipal garbage, which was piled up in a parking lot in the middle of town and was a big health concern. We also provided them with a water truck, so that they could take water from our system and deliver it to adjoining villages with the same problems. We also provided them with chainsaws in order to cut down wood in the surrounding forest to make fuel. And we provided medical supplies. And also we've, and I mentioned the chainsaws, and right now we're working on trying to figure out, by the way, since the Russians have started bombing the town again, these vehicles which we provided have been moved to adjoining villages that are out of the range of drones, but continue to provide services for the outlying villages in the area of Sviatohersk. Okay. And as I mentioned before, our next project is to provide them with a vehicle that has armor so that they can safely travel to and from the town to bring supplies, medical supplies, food, and also to evacuate the remaining citizens.
Okay, so most of the citizens have been evacuated.
Yes.
The ones that remain, there's little or no infrastructure. They need food, they need water, they need health care.
That's right.
And
you mentioned that because there's so many drones, the road that we traveled on to get to Sviatohersk now has nets over it most of the way in order to protect people driving. But it's dangerous to come in and out. Normally, Sviatohersk got aid from a lot of NGOs from Europe as well and would provide personal hygiene and food. Now that's difficult. Most NGOs have abandoned Sviatohersk. And our group is one of the few that continues to provide support.
And so you were just there?
I was, yes.
How long ago?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. So yeah. You're putting your life at risk.
There was some risk, not a great deal. We had a good connection with the local military authorities, and there are certain windows during the day that are relatively safe to travel. So we kind of scooted in and spent just a few hours at I was trying to make film to make a new sort of an updated film of what's going on there. But we were allowed 2 hours in town. And in fact, although there were no drone attacks while we were there, the following day there was a drone attack in the exact area where we had been filming.
Yeah. How does that feel?
Well, I wasn't there. I was okay. Truthfully, it's exciting in a certain way. I mean, if there were so many drones that you didn't know if you would live another minute, I wouldn't have the courage for that. But, you know, we factored the odds and thought about it a lot and felt that it was a reasonable risk to go.
So let's address the elephant in the room. What do the people in Ukraine believe led to this war?
Well, the people in Ukraine, you know, were part of the Soviet Union, and they know very well the Russian mentality, and they know what it's like to live under the thumb of an autocratic regime. So I'd say that there are people who are Russian sympathizers, no doubt. There are some in Sviatohrysk. But if anything, the war has catalyzed a sense of national identity that was nascent. And now that Ukraine is more unified than it's ever been in terms of its recognition that if they were to be taken over by Russia again, their lives would be dreadful. Russia has said that any Ukrainian who doesn't surrender their identity as a Ukrainian will be killed or deported, as they did so many times before. Like, for example, in Crimea, where all the Tatars were, or hundreds of thousands of them were sent to Siberia and replaced with native Russians as a way to reoccupy and sort of not just take over the land, but take over the identity of the Ukrainians as having any right to their own national identity. The Ukrainians know this well. They've seen, since the war began, the amount of violence, torture, and subjugation in the occupied territories. For example, people have to give up their Ukrainian passports. They're not allowed to speak Ukrainian. Their kids are kidnapped and taken to Russia and programmed to think that they're Russians, not Ukrainians. And it's something that Russia has done for 200 years. That's the way they work. They occupy a country, they move in Russians, they force people to only speak Russian, and they sort of try and subjugate the countries that they take over and turn them into property of their own Russian agenda, I guess you could call it. It's not a small thing. Ukrainians feel that it's a mass. It's survival. It's not just a changing of a political system, but it's changing their fundamental sense of identity. And it's a kind of rape of their consciousness that they're very aware is what's ahead of them if they should lose this war.
My guest is Ben Stott. He's a founder of the Ashland Sviatohrysk Aid Project, which offers support for residents of Ashland's sister city in Ukraine. You talk to the Ukrainians, what do they say can bring an end to the war?
My belief is that a ceasefire is not a viable solution for this war, because Russia has a long history of not keeping their agreements, not the least of which the Minsk Accords after the 2014 invasion, that any kind of ceasefire would just give Russia a chance to reconstitute its army and rebuild, and that their agenda, which is to take over, as I mentioned, sort of the whole consciousness of the country, but also their natural resources, because Ukraine is a very, very rich country in oil and natural gas and coal and steel and titanium and chromium. And interestingly, most of those resources are found in the south and the east of Ukraine, where Russia is trying to conquer.
Ukraine was once the home of a lot of nuclear weapons.
Yes. I think it was 1994, the United States and England and France agreed with Russia that if Ukraine surrendered their nuclear weapons, that Russia would guarantee the national borders of Ukraine forever. And that was signed by our country, that we guaranteed that we would protect them going forward. Not only Russia broke that agreement, but the United States and Europe also didn't keep their end of the bargain. So if Ukraine had kept their nuclear weapons, this war would never have happened. And I might add that many people talk about NATO expansion as an excuse for Russia invading Ukraine. I'd like to just say that that is Russian disinformation, because for one thing, if Ukraine had been part of NATO, this war never would have happened. The Balkan countries that asked to join NATO after the dissolution of the Soviet Union didn't do so because the United States was forcing them to. They did it out of desperation because they were very aware that they were at risk of reinvasion by the Russians. And so, you know, Russia has sort of shot themselves in the foot because since the war started, now two more countries have joined NATO, not because of Western pressure, but because they themselves felt the threat of Russia's new imperialist ambitions. And
you mentioned that even in Ukraine, there are Russian sympathizers. What are they saying?
It's hard to know exactly. But people, you know, mostly they're older people who remember the time of when the Soviet Union was there. Of course, they were young then, and so part of their memories that are sort of fond, you know, are partly that they were young and they have the memories of being young and vital, and the Soviet Union provided a kind of paternalistic situation where, you know, you were taken care of by the state and you didn't have to worry about education, and, you know, people had food. They had no freedom, but at least they had some basic survival. And so older people now who are feeling so vulnerable, they sort of have a sort of vague memory of that things weren't so bad when the Soviet Union was in charge. And so, and particularly in the East, where people do speak Russian mostly, they have kind of a faint idea that maybe things would be better if it was the way it was, it used to be. And you can't deny that there are maybe 10% of the people, at least in the East and some in the South, especially in places where people have Russian as their native language, have mixed feelings about Russia. I have no idea how they can explain that to themselves when they see what Russia is doing to their country, where every place where Russia says they're liberating the town, their form of liberation is to destroy it down to the ground. Every city that Russia invades is reduced to rubble, and civilians are shot. And in Dnipro, now the people don't even have any water left because the Russians haven't put any money into to kind of building back the cities that they've destroyed.
Well, if I may, when you speak and I hear the passion in your voice, you have a fondness for Ukraine and Sviatohersk.
I do.
As if you were an adopted son or you grew up there or you have family there.
Yeah, I don't have any racial or heritage in Ukraine, but having been there and when I was there, I did interviews with Ukrainian people as I went along, which I published on a blog that I did. So I got to know quite a few Ukrainians, and I'm just so impressed by their courage and their resilience and their ability to stand up to what is an implacable and, frankly, I think evil force that's just looming over them.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds left, and so I'm going to ask you, what is the best case scenario between the sister cities, Ashland and Sviatohersk, going forward?
At this moment, the situation is extremely difficult. It's possible that Sviatohersk will be reinvaded. We can't know for sure. The front lines are very close. But in the long term, I feel confident that Ukraine will prevail because Russia is crumbling economically. Their army has very poor morale. And I think that the time will come when Sviatohersk will be returned to economic and social vibrancy. That's our goal, to help that happen.
Okay, very quickly, if anyone wants to get involved with the Ashland Sviatohirsk Aid Project, what should they do?
Yeah, we have a website, which is asapashland.org.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. My guest was Ben Stott. He's the founder of the Ashland Sviatohirsk Aid Project.